And my name is Kimberly Kelly, and I will be interviewing Detroit musician Matthew Smith for Wayne State University Oral Archives class, and this interview will be housed at the Ruther. Okay, so Matthew Smith, let's begin with a little background. Were you born in the Metro Detroit area, or?
Born in Ann Arbor, raised in Hamtramck, went to school in Detroit, and then moved around all the suburbs, and then went back to Ann Arbor to go to college, and then came back to Hamtramck, and I basically lived since then in the Detroit area.
Okay, and what kind of your household? Were you raised in a musical household?
There were records playing all the time. There were a lot of records, and there were polka musicians in the family, beyond that, I was probably the first really obsessive, serious musician. Although I found out later that my grandfathers were both guitar players. After both of them had died, I found out they were guitarists. But I didn't know that when I was growing up. You know.
So what kind of music was played in your house? I know you mentioned polka.
Well, that wasn't really played in my house. That was just my relatives. And, I probably sat around listening to polka music a little bit as a kid, but mainly my dad played a lot of jazz records. My mom played classical records and rock and roll stuff when she was a teacher, and her students would, give her Moody Blues records and the Jim Queskin Jug Band and Black Sabbath and whatever else. And so, I was exposed to that around the house. That and the radio. I mean, the radio was a big thing. You know.
Okay. Now, how do you think that music influenced your music now, or do you think it did?
I think there's this sort of omnivorous thing, I guess that's the right word for it, where I've absorbed all the music I've heard my whole life and kind of learned how to play in a variety of styles and sort of mix them all up at the same time. So I kind of have absorbed everything I've heard. And in the case of, I've been playing more and more improvisational music and stuff that could be termed jazz or avant-garde experimental music. And I think that all that is definitely related to the jazz music I heard as a kid and movie soundtracks, hearing Ligeti on the 2001 A Space Odyssey soundtrack. I mean, so my exposure to all these things happened a long time ago, and then my band Outrageous Cherry seems to be based on, it seems to always harken back to this moment in the 60s where the Turtles and the Association were on the radio, and that kind of triggered Outrageous Cherry, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know.
So you play a variety of instruments. What was the first instrument you learned to play? How did that come about?
Trumpet. Because of the polka connection. And then later on I picked up the guitar, and once I picked up the guitar, I started to eradicate any kind of normalcy or, normal human being behavior from my life, mm-hmm. Stopped bowling, stopped playing chess, basically stopped everything except reading and watching Godzilla movies and things like that.
So what age was that you started playing guitar?
Oh, boy, that must have been, 77 or so. I must have been, 13 or 14 or something.
Okay. Is that when your interest in performing, recording, and, sharing your music started?
I'm not really sure. I think it was just, being a kid in the late 70s, in Detroit, having moved around a bit, and at some point I found myself living in Warren, Michigan, which was just where I just totally didn't fit in there, having come from the city. And so I basically, by the time I was 13 or 14, I felt completely adrift from everything. I was cut loose from my juvenile delinquent friends I grew up with, and I didn't really, I felt really at odds with everything. So I guess that I was drawn to music as sort of from the perspective of being a complete social outcast and just sort of and kind of pursuing it aggressively as a as an escape from whatever everybody else was doing.
I read that you're a prolific songwriter. Is that when your songwriting started? Or?
Not really, no. It was more like I just started playing with musicians. I think I just wanted to hang out with people who were interested in stuff that was interesting, that wasn't whatever was going on in the mainstream at the time. But the songwriting, I think I made my first attempt at songwriting back then, but I don't think I ever really wrote anything I was truly happy with until I was about near, you know, my late 20s or nearly 30. You know, up until that point, I mean, I'd made records and things and played with all these different bands, but it wasn't until my late 20s, I guess, when I was playing, started playing with the Volbeats in the late 80s, that I suddenly felt I was writing music that was as good as my record collection, that was as good as the people that had influenced me. You know?
Yeah. All of your music, did you self-teach yourself to read music and write, or when you learned trumpet, was that in school?
Yeah, I was in band in school, so okay. I had trumpet, and then I was in choir, and then I took guitar lessons briefly, but I always had a really good ear, so like whenever I was in those situations, my ear was always faster than my eye, so I never developed my sight reading skills because it wasn't necessary, because my ear was so quick. I could follow anything. Even when I didn't have the technical ability to execute what I was hearing in my head, I could just fake it. And that's basically sort of what I still do, I guess. But it got to a point in high school playing the trumpet. Eventually I stopped playing the trumpet for a long time. It's something I've more recently picked up again. But, you know, I'd find myself sitting in band and I'd hear the piece once and remember it and play it. I would try to avoid having to read notes off a page whenever possible.
What would you consider your first success in music?
I never ever thought of it as success. I had other people tell me, hey, that was successful. And I was like, it was? Yeah, yeah, you've had success with this. I'm like, really? I thought it was... you know, I thought it was just a complicated mess. I'm like, no, that was success. I never thought of it like that. You know, I just kind of did it, not really knowing exactly what else to do with myself. I mean, I went to college wanting to be a filmmaker, basically because there wasn't really anything else going on at U of M that I really wanted to focus on. You know, I mean, I studied a lot of different things. I took music courses and. Was in an Indonesian gamelan ensemble, and I studied composition with William Bolcom and William Albright. So I had kind of a broad education there, but basically I got out of there thinking, I'll be a filmmaker. But then I got out of school and realized that making films at that point was, especially if you were using actual film and not going to video, which was happening at the time, if you wanted to make films, you had to have a lot of money. You had to be good at raising money, and that was the qualification for being a filmmaker, was being able to hustle people out of, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or even tens of thousands. And, I mean, I'm able to hustle people out of a thousand or, you know, a few thousand here and there, but not the thousands required to do the kind of things that, you know, that an obsessive filmmaker requires to do things beyond making little avant-garde films of exploded shoelace factories and things like that, which is what I was doing, you know. But, so making records, it was more economical to produce albums, and I kind of drew on the same mentality that I would use making a film, making albums. I just basically turned that obsession towards record production.
Yeah, you know, I've read that when you were in the Volbeats, you appeared in the movie Shop Girl.
Yeah.
What was that like, that since you went to school for that? Was that the first film you were in? I think you had a couple credits.
There's a bunch of credits in films. Basically, the guys in Hollywood who are professional professional guys who place songs in movies, mm-hmm. those guys keep their distance from me. They don't work with me at all. And they probably film soundtrack people are... they keep their distance as well, because once they realize I'm a multi-instrumentalist, I'm a threat to their, you know, job doing the score for the film, and that's happened on several occasions. But there are film directors who are fans of my work, and so occasionally a film director will tell the soundtrack people, I want this guy either in the movie, or I want his song, or I want this, and it's always the director, because if it were up to the culture of song placement in Hollywood. I would just be on the, you know, I would be on the outside of that, you know. So, but luckily there's a bunch of filmmakers that stumbled across my stuff or are fans, and so there's a bunch of things have ended up in movies. And in the case of Shop Girl, the filmmaker liked us so much that he was, you know, I think he was kind of stunned at how few people knew about the Volbeats, you know, because at that point we had sort of already embarked on a total, you know, a total descent into complete obscurity, I guess. And so he wanted us in the film on the screen because he wanted people to recognize us, you know. He was really, Anand Tucker, the director, was adamant about that. You know, as it turned out, you know, the film ended up twice as long as it was supposed to be, and he had to cut half of it out. So a lot of stuff ended up on the cutting room floor, but we're still, you know, our whole song is in it, and you get to see us on screen just long enough, if you don't blink, to see a band that, you know, that's us. So it was, you know, it didn't sort of all of a sudden bring us, you know, an enormous amount of attention or anything, but, you know, just people who know us or see the film on TV late at night and just think they're hallucinating when we come on.
Now, I've also read that you work with Detroit artists like Rodriguez and Nathaniel Mayer. Can you elaborate how that work came about? Either one or both?
You know, old weird dudes seek me out.
Okay. I didn't know if you saw them or they saw you. Okay.
It's kind of both, I guess. You know, I mean, I'm a fan. I mean, with both of those guys, I was a fan of their stuff, and I met Nathaniel Mayer when he started playing again after a 40-year hiatus where he was on the streets of Detroit, you know, up to nothing good. You know, he sort of came back all of a sudden and wanted to make records again. And the minute I found out he was, you know, a visible presence again, he played a Sunday afternoon UAW picnic. And I got a phone call, like, he's, you know, Nathaniel's performing at this UAW picnic in an hour. So I just, like, you know, threw my clothes on, ran over there and saw him perform. And like in 100-degree weather, wearing this huge, thick blue tuxedo. And, you know, he didn't have dentures yet. So, you know, when he got a record deal, he bought him dentures. He didn't have the dentures yet, so it sounded like he was singing in Japanese. It was like a Japanese James Brown. But it was like in this 100-degree heat, he was giving it everything he had. He was obviously a great performer, and you know. So I met him there, and he was a real nice guy. But we didn't get to know each other until a few years later, after he'd already made a comeback record. Then his record label hooked me up because the band he was playing with was kind of turning down gigs because they didn't want to leave Detroit and go on tour, apparently. So I ended up getting the call, and I put a band together, and we had a 20-minute rehearsal, and then jumped in a van and went on tour with the Black Keys, and that was my introduction to Nathaniel Mayer. Was, you know, I was just thrown right into it. And and Rodriguez was kind of similar. I mean, I had been a fan of his music through the 90s. I'd been touring with an Australian guy, Simon Bonney, early 90s, we had an English tour manager, and he was playing this tape of Cold Fact, playing the Cold Fact album on cassette in the van. And, you know, I was like, man, this guy sounds like he's singing about my hometown, man. And he's like, no, it can't be. No. He died of a heroin overdose in the 70s, man. I'm like, wow. And then, you know, gradually I tracked down the Rodriguez records, and then one day, a friend of mine comes into the record store I was working at the time, because I've worked in record stores. I used to work at Car City Records on the East Side, you know, on and off through all these different things. And I was working at the record store one day, and Willie Wilson, who was a DET DJ at the time, walked in, and he's like, Rodriguez lives in Detroit. I'm like, you're kidding. He's like, no, I'm not kidding. You know, at that point, we knew he was alive, but... Yeah, then a week later, I'm playing a gig with Monster Island with Kerry Lauren from Destroy All Monsters, and we're doing a show, and I think it was Willie that walked up to me and pointed him out and said, that's him. And he was there. He was at one of my gigs a week later after I found out that he's living in Detroit and he's alive and well. And, you know, I went up and talked to him, chatted with him, and all my friends that were there at that point had heard his record. You know, so there were the musicians in town had started to know about him. This is late 90s. But... I just bump into him all the time for years, and it took years to get him to really open up and have a conversation with me that wasn't totally guarded, and it took a few more years after that to get him to actually play some music. And then a few years ago, I just, you know, I was at home recovering from a gallbladder surgery operation, and it's just feeling like I'm okay to put a guitar on without, you know, the stitches all being ripped up. And you're feeling like I could play guitar, you know, I think I could do this now. After a couple weeks of recovery, and then I get a phone call from Rodriguez's daughter, like, "Hey, Matt, are you doing anything tomorrow night?" No, what's going on? Or, you know, I am. I do have something to do, but what's going on? Well, would you play guitar with my dad tomorrow? I'm like, well, where's he playing? The Beacon Theater in New York. I'm like, oh, God. So another situation, I had to put a band together in 5 minutes and call her back. I said, give me 10 minutes to think about this. And I thought about it for 10 minutes, and I thought, all right, I'll do it. Put the band together. No rehearsal. You know, I got on a plane the next morning at 6 a.m., flew out, slept on the couches backstage a little bit, and, you know, went out and played. And then it went well, and they kept us. After we did a few New York shows, and after that they said, hey, can you stay out for another 6 weeks? So I recovered from my surgery while I was touring with Rodriguez, and it was kind of a good thing. It was good to, you know, better than sitting around the house, you know. But, yeah, so it was weird because he and I have played around Detroit when, you know, just played Vietnam vet bars, like, you know, the old Miami and what's that place, the Corktown something or other, some place across from the Wayne State, you know, sports field or whatever. And we played a bunch of, you know, oddball gigs, little weird Detroit gigs, but, you know, all of a sudden that was like, you know, we're out playing stadiums and giant halls, you know, it was crazy.
You mentioned earlier Simon Bonney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you were in, was it Crime in the City Solution?
Yeah, yeah.
How did so it started in the 70s in Australia.
Right.
And then it became a Detroit band, and you're a member. How does that happen?
It's really complicated, but the short version is that I saw them in the 80s. I'd picked up on their records, and I saw them live and thought they were the greatest band I'd ever seen. You know, they played a gig in Ann Arbor, and, you know, in front of like 20 or 30 people in 88, and they were brilliant, and they were a band that was at that time that was made up of members of the German band Einstürzende Neubauten and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and a guy from DAF. I mean, it was just this superstar group of people from really, you know, strange groups that I really admired, and all together they were just you know, they were like a cross between the Doors and Can. I mean, they were just brilliant. And so I kind of made a point of kind of somehow staying in touch with them. I just you know, met them at that gig, and they just kind of, we started crossing paths, and I kind of put the word out with a journalist at the time, Tom Jurek, that, you know, I guess I'd heard when Crime, the first time they broke up in like 1990, I'd heard Simon was doing a solo record, and I put the word out through this journalist, Tom Jurek, that, you know, yeah, if, you know, like, he had played me some tapes he had of what Simon was working on, and I said, hey, you know, if he needs a bass player, tell him I'll play upright bass. You know, he was doing this kind of country-ish stuff that wasn't too far off from what the Volbeats were doing at that point. So, anyway, he comes through Detroit, plays in Ann Arbor, and I get the phone call, hey, why don't you bring your upright bass and jam with us? And that was, at that time, that was actually an instrument that I would offer if I met somebody I wanted to play with. I'd often say, hey, you need an upright bass player, because Detroit's so filled with guitarists. They're on every street corner. I mean, you know, being a guitar player in Detroit is completely, you know, it's like breathing. It's like nobody cares, you know. So I didn't really offer myself up as a guitar player, even though that's really what I'm best at. I'd offered myself as an upright bass player, which I don't play at all. I play very minimal. But that's probably better, because people who play it busy on people's records is unnecessary. So I showed up with my upright bass and played in Ann Arbor and Detroit with them, just sat in with them. And then the next thing I knew, I was getting calls to do sessions. And I got a call to do a residency in New York. And then we did touring. And so I kind of became, you know, one of Simon's, you know, collaborators on his solo career. And then eventually the solo career, it looked like it was going to take off, like a lot of things, you know, and then it just kind of the second album we did didn't take off, and third album we did didn't get released, and you know, it was one of those deals. So he just drifted out of music. He was living in LA at the time, but you know, he ended up going back to Australia, and we didn't talk for a long time. And how Crime got back together, I think I had a lot to do with that, because I went out and saw the movie Wings of Desire, which I hadn't seen since the 80s, and there's a scene in the movie where Crime and the City Solution is in the movie playing, where they're on screen longer than the Volbeats and Shop Girl. But I saw the movie again after all these decades, and I watched it, and I just thought to myself, you know, Crime never finished what they were doing. You know, it's unfinished business. They were this band that was great, that you know, they didn't get the, you know, they didn't connect the way they should have with the world. And I started, you know, writing the guys in the band and kind of bugging them. And then one thing led to another, and the guitar player, the German guitarist Alexander Hacke, happened to be in New York, and a friend of mine tipped me off that he was hanging out in New York, and so we kind of hooked it up with me and my friend Troy Gregory from Detroit, our friend Jim White, who's an Australian who lives in New York, the German who was in New York, and everybody started making phone calls and sending emails. And once Alexander Hacke said yes, that he would do it, the whole thing fell into place. And so all of a sudden, they were re-signed to their old record company, Mute, and everybody got flown to Detroit, and suddenly they're a Detroit band. And so we rehearsed and made an album here. And then we did a bunch of touring, a couple tours, Europe, U.S., Australia. But in Australia, everybody started having trouble getting along, and the band just sort of fragmented, you know, very unexpectedly. And we had a European tour set up that we didn't end up doing, which was a real drag. But the band kind of went on hiatus, and that's where it's at right now. We did an album, record company's like, well, this did well, let's do another one. And we're all, it's back to where it was in 1990. So that's the whole story.
You're the founding member of Outrageous Cherry, mm-hmm. and I read that it started as a solo project. Is that not true?
It's not exactly true. I've read that. What it was, maybe it is true. No, what it was, I just had reached a point at that point where I was playing with the Volbeats, and the Volbeats at that point were making some good music and having a lot of trouble finding people to put our records out. Eventually we signed with a label that was really problematic in the early 90s, and did a few records that are impossible to find. But at that point I was really feeling like I wasn't really writing the kind of songs I wanted to be writing. I felt like I was more interested in just playing on other people's records, and I started to see myself as, oh, you know, I should focus on being a session guy, playing on other people's records. And I'd played with this Japanese guy, Yuji Oniki, Japanese American, grew up in both countries, you know. And in the late 80s, I worked with him, and that was the first record I ever produced for another artist, where he just liked what I was doing and said, you know, hey, you know, I heard these recordings you've been doing, will you produce my record? And suddenly I'm a record producer, you know, working for other artists other than myself. So I was starting to see myself as more of a behind the scenes guy working with other people, you know. And then this whole Outrageous Cherry thing was just my friend Troy, who I've played with on and off, Troy Gregory. We've crossed paths over and over throughout the years playing in different projects. I was in his band The Witches for a while, and some other things. But he at that time was playing with the heavy metal band Prong in New York, and they were managed by the guy that managed The Replacements, and Troy played him a little acoustic tape of him recording me playing one of my songs, and the guy was like, you know, I want to hear this guy with a band. So Troy's like, The Replacements manager wants to hear you with a band, go make a tape. So I'm like, okay. And I went and made a tape, you know, I jammed with different musicians, and I was very unhappy with everything and how it was sounding, and I really wasn't entirely confident about the songs either. And then at some point I just sat down and thought, well, who are some musicians that are just an unlikely combination of people, you know? And I picked, three musicians that didn't know each other, that were all different ages, that were coming from different backgrounds, you know, and you know, Susanna Mraz was my ex-girlfriend at the time, and she wasn't a drummer, but she was a dancer, so I figured she had good rhythm, and so I put her on a real simple kit like the Gorries or the Velvet Underground without anything but a snare and a tom, and tried her out, and she was able to play, you know, lay down great rhythm. So I thought, okay, well, that's good. And then I had, there was a guitar player I'd seen around town, Chad Gilchrist. I'd seen him in Ann Arbor, and he was just, looked like a living Doonesbury comic. He just did not look like a normal human being. And he was, you know, would play guitar solos and halfway through it throw his guitar on the floor. And, you know, I thought, well, this guy has something. So I thought of him as a bass player. I could tell that he had a good ear by watching him. And I jammed with him one time and I could tell. And then Larry Ray was this guitar player that had played with a lot of bands going back through the 70s in Detroit. And he was older than me. But he came over to sell me some records once, and he turned out to have a really good ear as well. You know, so all these people had really good listening abilities, which is, at that time, I felt was missing from most of the rock and roll. The whole grunge revolution was all people who, you know, all of music in the 80s and 90s to me seemed to be guys that had really worked out their parts, rehearsed it all, and they were just kind of going through the motions. I felt like it was people had turned their amps up louder, clubs had gotten louder, everything had gotten very loud, and all the music that you would hear just seemed to be put together as a product, and it was based on people knowing their parts and just going through the drill. And I felt like the energy of rock and roll, I mean, for me, just really was I was feeling less and less of it from the music I was hearing. So it was important to me to you know, try and jam with some people that could actually play by ear and really in. So the first rehearsal I had with these guys, it was just intended to make a tape. But the minute we were tuning our guitars and just making sound in the room, before we were even playing my songs, I could hear the energy. I could hear that, okay, these people are listening to one another. And so it became a band out of the blue. And the Outrageous Cherry concept was a friend of mine, concept. My friend Colleen Laverty wanted to have a group where she would be the singer and wanted me to write some sort of bubblegum songs with completely demented, sick lyrics, you know, and just, you know, had this idea. And then she just kind of lost interest and dropped out of it. So the songs I was writing were kind of connected to her concept. You know, they were sort of like, you know, these kind of bubblegum songs. And bubblegum songs are subversive anyway. I mean, you know, that to me, the whole bubblegum thing, there's a sinister and kind of twisted undercurrent to all the bubblegum music, which I thought, you know, was sort of, in a way, it was empathetic to what, you know, Lou Reed and the Velvets were doing, and Leonard Cohen even, you know. And, you know, so I kind of, all these things kind of came together, and suddenly, you know, the project of the girl sort of being kind of a 21st century, you know, like subterranean Petula Clark, you know, like with, you know, with all kinds of, you know, psychological issues, you know, I became that. I became the stand-in for the, you know, the female front person of it. And so, you know, I kind of got pushed into being a front man in a band that, you know, was, you know, wasn't really what I intended to do. But the music sounded good, so we just were like, let's go make a tape. And we made the tape. And the manager guy in New York heard the tape, of course, didn't like it. You know, he probably wanted something that sounded like grunge. So I was happy with the tape. The tape, you know, was excited about it. So I kind of pursued it, and we ended up doing more recordings. And, you know, and
what is this song?
Pretty Girls Gonna Say Anything. Yeah, that one came a few years later. The first one was Pale, Frail, Lovely One. That was our first single. And everyone tells me, here's, oh, that should have been a hit. And it should have, you know. And it actually, they started to play it on the radio in Detroit, but because it was a local record, at the time it was a local 45, and it didn't have, you know, major label, you know, intimidation and payola behind it, you know. So we didn't go further than getting played a little bit, but they played it a little bit and people responded to it to the point where I got a surprising amount of feedback about just a couple of times it got played on commercial radio. So I saw where this could go. You know, this was a different type of song, and it was, you know, it was out there. And then the album came out, and, you know, it just kind of, things proceeded slowly. We just didn't have the energy behind us to push it out there. But, you know, we had people helping us. I mean, once our album came out, the first band that asked us to tour with them was Wilco. And Wilco had just formed, and they were like, you know, and I didn't even know who they were, you know. And they just contacted one of our label guys, and just next thing I know, we're touring with them. So, you know, we...
I've seen videos of you performing on stage with Wilco. They're huge fans of you.
Yeah, they were big fans, and like, they just became really good friends. And, you know, when they started off, their thing was a little more in the alternative country realm. And then as time went on, they became a lot weirder and more experimental and moody and strange. And, they've gotten consistently, more, you know, they've just continued to always keep it interesting. So I've always been following what they're doing, and we've remained really good friends and kind of musical, what's the word for it? Kindred spirits.
you mentioned producing. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you talk about either producing that album? Was it their debut album, or producing compared to writing?
Well, in addition to my writing and singing in bands and all this stuff I kind of found myself dragged into doing, you know, people continued to occasionally ask me to produce their records, you know, not based on any track record of hits, but just liking the sound of what I'm doing, and, you know. And The Go was a situation like that where I saw them and immediately felt I'd discovered the best band I'd ever heard. I felt they were at least as good as the Stooges and MC5, you know, like a Rolling Stones level band, you know. And they, from the very first time I saw them, I felt they were just unbelievable. And they asked me to produce them. I said, I can produce you guys. I said, but, you know, you really are so good that you need somebody to sell you. I didn't really want to reenact what I did with the Outrageous Cherry records, which is, up to that point, had been great records with nothing behind it to push them. I said, you know, I sent them to my friend Kim Fowley, who I had worked with, who became a real pivotal figure in my whole musical thing. And Kim was a producer, but also a guy who had been in the industry for years and was, really kind of knew the game and was an international presence. A controversial guy, but you know, somebody who knew things that a lot of us were still learning, you know. And I said, you know, you should, you know, do it with Kim. I think he would be able to sell this thing. So they got with Kim, and, you know, we'd send him the stuff, and Kim, just, there was something about the music that just didn't seem commercial enough for him. Even though Kim is a weird guy, he's made weird and very non-commercial records, in my opinion. He just said that, there's something, you know, these drums, you know, the guys, you know, there's too many cymbals all over the place, and if I show up and I say I want to hear the drum beat to Psychotic Reaction, and they don't know what I'm talking about, I'm on the next plane, man. So he just kind of didn't see dollar signs with these guys, you know. So he didn't do it. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll do it. And then, you know, right about that time, Kim, who didn't want to produce him, but still called me up and said, hey, they're making this movie Detroit Rock City. They're Hollywood people who don't know anything about Detroit. Send me a tape of The Go. I'll try to get them in the movie. And so I ended up doing a demo with them. And at that point, Jack White had just joined the group. And he was just getting started with the White Stripes. And, you know, he had only a very small group of people who knew who he was. But the people who knew who he was were already kind of pushing him. He had kind of a support group of people that kind of were already envisioning him as a star, I think, you know. And so he ended up joining The Go, and we did a demo in his living room. And the Hollywood people, of course, didn't know what to make of it and didn't want it, and they ended up using one of Kim's Runaways songs instead. But he tried. And but that tape basically got them signed to Sub Pop. And so Sub Pop signed them, and we made the record. And I produced it, Jim Diamond engineered it. But the recording musically went very, very smoothly, but the peripheral stuff that went on made it complicated, because at the time the whole quote garage rock scene was coming up in Detroit at that time. Just a lot of bands that were part of this little scene that were kind of ambitious but kind of not very forthcoming in their ambition, just kind of, you know, trying to play the bars and be cool and all that. And so when the Go got their record deal, you know, it just created a situation where they had all these different people giving them their 2 cents on the record, and some people being encouraging, but most people being, you know, discouraging about the fact that, you know, that they were making a record, you know, that was going to be produced by somebody with totally weird musical taste, and, you know, that people were just trying to tell them, you know, you guys are blowing your chance, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So anyway, we made the record we wanted to make, but the band was really, you know, they were young guys, and I think there was a lot of peer pressure from the garage, you know, scene. And so it just created a lot of tension, and that may have had something to do with the fact that Jack was really uneasy about the whole thing, and he just seemed really tense through the whole process, and played real well, but by the end of it, he wanted to redo all his guitars, and I wouldn't let him, and because, you know, we didn't have the money for it, really. Sub Pop gave us a shoestring budget, you know. I think we were sort of treated by Sub Pop like, okay, well, these guys are from Detroit, you know, they're these idiot savants who just happened to, like, come up with some good rock and roll tunes, so we'll give them a shoestring budget, and maybe they'll make some, you know, something that people, you know, will be able to listen to. But they didn't, you know, they didn't indulge us as artists. They treated us like, you know, like some guys they found in the gutter, and, you know, just, you know, and that, basically, that's, you know, that was my perception of the situation. But I was okay with that. I'm just like, you know, we don't need money to make a rock and roll record. We can do, you know. But anyway, so that's what happened there. It was, we made a record that really was influential and really important, and, you know, and all that. And I think Jack's kind of disowned the record because he didn't, you know, he didn't like that he didn't have control over it. But the rest of the band, as far as I know, was pretty happy with it. And the singer, Bobby, was very, basically told me after we made it, he said, Matt, I want to thank you for making a record that makes people angry. He's like, I didn't think rock and roll was capable of doing that anymore, and you did it. He goes, people either love this record or it makes them just tense and angry. And that's what rock and roll is supposed to do. And I was like, yeah, thanks, you know. I agree, rock and roll is supposed to do that, you know. So anyway, that's...
Is there one aspect of music you prefer, writing, producing, performing? Because you do all of them. In that case, mm-hmm. You were just producing, you weren't writing or performing.
I didn't write because some of these groups I work with, I'll write if it's necessary or if someone asks me to, but in most of my production situations, I tend to work with people who don't need writing help, you know, people that already have something going on that's that I don't have to fix, you know. But I like all the different parts of the process. I kind of like to do them all I think if I just did one of them, I'd get unhappy with it really fast. I think I'm just too, you know, I'm pretty much, you know, I mean, there are so many things that I'm, you know, able to do that if I focused on one, you know, maybe it just doesn't interest me, really. You know, I mean, I'm more interested in just kind of always kind of stumbling upon something new. I mean, I don't know, I guess that's what it is. But I mean, it wasn't really, you know, I didn't know when I got started in playing in music that I was going to be, you know, I may have, I don't know what I thought I was going to do, but I may have thought, oh, I'll just get in a band and we'll get a record deal and make some records and people will buy our records. I didn't know that I was going to play in 1,000 bands and produce, you know, over 50 albums, you know. I mean, I didn't know I was going to do that, you know. I just sort of, it's just when you do this kind of thing, you just keep crossing paths with people and walking into different situations, you know.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. You collaborate with a lot of different bands. What is it about these bands that draw you to them? Is it a common theme musically, or the ability to work with different artists? Is it
It's more like if I hear something that's really extraordinary, you know, I kind of feel, and especially I think it's kind of the way the direction music's gone in. I mean, it's sort of, I feel sometimes a lot of the really, really talented people that are kind of more in line with my musical taste have a tendency to get overlooked because they're more preoccupied with their artistic thing than the self-promotion aspect or the ego aspect and all that. And it just seems like, I mean, I'm sure there's some good singer-songwriters and musicians out there that have huge egos I'm sure there's some guys out there with huge egos nowadays that are great songwriters, that are fantastic, but I find that, like, you know, the better musicians, they're not as ego driven. They're not out there necessarily pushing themselves as much, or they're more likely to walk in and make a record with somebody else who doesn't get it. So if I feel like, you know, I like to work with people where I feel like, okay, well, if I don't do this record, someone else is going to do it and screw it up. And I've seen that happen to a lot of people, where just talented people come out and great bands, and you think, well, they're the next big thing, and then they go in and make a record with somebody who's just not sympathetic to their eccentricities and their individuality, and then they crank out something that misses capturing what it was, and then the band thinks it's their fault and internalizes it, and they, you know, get a complex about it and give up, you know. And I've seen so many musicians, I've seen more musicians give up than stick with it. And it's usually for little things like that, you know, just being in there with a engineer, producer that's not sympathetic to it, you know, just stuff like that.
Is there any bands currently that you're working with that you'd like to speak about?
I went to Vancouver and produced an album for a really good songwriter named Marissa Johnson. And she's, you know, someone who's been on the Vancouver scene for a bit. And I just produced her first solo record. And that's really the only group. I'm the last group I worked with. There are bands I like, but the last bands that I worked with where I just thought, you know, I must make a record here and do this, because if I don't do it, no one else is going to get it right, was a band called The Crooks. And I did one record with them, and they were this little band from the suburbs of these kids that were still in high school. It sounded like Led Zeppelin. I mean, they looked like the Osmonds, but they played like Led Zeppelin, and it was, you know, they were frighteningly good. And I recorded an album with them on an 8-track in my living room, and couldn't get any labels to put it out because they were just, oh, these guys are too young, you know, we don't want to deal with their parents, and, you know, so I ended up putting it out myself, and the band is since broken up, you know, but that record, that's a record that's likely to be rediscovered. I think it's already being rediscovered by the weird record collecting, you know, Cognoscenti. The other band that I worked with is a band that's still together called the Deadbeat Beat, and I made a record with them that came out only on cassette. Why it's not out on vinyl, why people aren't jumping all over that record, I have no idea. But that's a band that can write songs. It's real good. My current drummer in Outrageous Cherry, Maria, actually plays in that band as well. So, you know.
So you've chosen to stay in Michigan, and where there might be more opportunities in the music industry outside of Michigan, what is it about staying in the Metro Detroit area? What do you think it is about Detroit that's made your music flourish?
Well, I've been able to get it around the world from here somehow. I don't know how it came about, but, you know, because there's obviously no industry here since Motown left, other than like guys, little labels out of people's garages, basically. But I just, you know, I had people advising me to leave and go to L.A. or New York for years, you know. But by the late 90s, I had a record deal. I got discovered by the Alan McGee from Creation Records, and he was starting a new label called Pop Tones. And Alan signed me for my fourth album with Outrageous Cherry, and which had actually been released previously by an LA label, Delphi 2000, was an old label that was restarted and had some hip young guys working at the label, and they put our label out on this, put our record out on this legendary label. But that was a domestic thing, and then Joe Foster and Alan McGee ended up releasing our stuff in all over the world with Pop Tones, and then at some point Little Steven became a big fan of it too, from Springsteen's band, and he just suddenly, after he was doing the Sopranos show, he suddenly had his own radio show, and it got syndicated, and so all of a sudden Outrageous Cherry got on the radio through an unlikely way, because before it was, we'd get a little airplay and it would drop off, but all of a sudden we're getting airplay on a large level, but through a different system. It wasn't like the top 40 or something, it was through this different thing. So all those things were kind of, to go back to your very first question, those are what the people have referred to as success with this stuff, it's like, that kind of thing. As opposed to just like, riding around in limousines, and with sunglasses on, acting weird, And
you can do that in Detroit.
Yeah, we can, I guess we could. The thing is, it's like, if I'd have moved somewhere else, there's just no way I could have met the kind of people I've worked with here, And, all the musicians that I've worked with out of Detroit are just they really are the best musicians in the world. I mean, this city, for whatever reason, produces these kind of individuals. They have a really different different way of working, just a different vibe than people from other places. And the other people I've worked from other places, a lot of times they've come to me, they've come here, rather than have whether they're Australians or whether it's, Paul Wine Jones. The late Paul Wine Jones is a Mississippi, was the last of the great Mississippi bluesmen, and his label sent him to Detroit to record with me. So I found these people coming to me in Detroit. So I'm really glad I didn't move to New York or L.A., because in New York or L.A., you're just surrounded by industry, and you're surrounded by hype and buzz and all these other things that, which are really good if you're into a kind of, capitalistic outlook that kind of is more focused on success in those terms, as opposed to just getting involved in unpredictable things, which is more where I'm at. But I just think that it would have been really I couldn't have done that in any other city, and I've traveled around enough that I've met the musicians in all the other cities. Like I've made a point of meeting all the musicians, as many as possible of the people I'd like to meet, and in other cities, and the ones I'd like to work with. And so I feel like, somehow, Detroit, even though I came up in a post Motown, really bleak musical landscape in the 80s, and it was bleak in the late 70s, 80s. There was just no way you could. No way you could get your record, anybody to pay attention to your record in those days, I mean, there were a couple of guys that maybe had some mafia connections out in New Jersey or something that got something going, but like, aside from them, not naming names, but aside from that, the occasional record that would creep out of Detroit, there just was, Detroit was left behind after Motown, and I don't think anybody wanted to hear about it. So I think the fact that I've been able to sort of have an international career with Detroit as a base, it's something that, it's a good thing.
Is there an artist or a venue in Detroit that you feel is important or was influential in the Detroit music scene that people haven't listened to or should visit, a venue if it's mm-hmm. a place they should visit?
Yeah, well, in the 80s, it was just a bunch of people scraping away in bars, The Gorries, Viva Cauldron, all the bands were just playing bars. In the 90s, it was a place called Zoot's. And Zoot's was a little coffee house in the middle of the Cass Corridor down at 2nd. And it was like an ex-whorehouse that had been turned into a, you know, like little Wayne State student coffee house. And they started having bands. And the key to it was the guys who ran the place said no to everybody. All the bands would ask to play, they'd just be like, no, 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 we don't want to hear that. And they would only say yes to bands that the guys who worked there really wanted to hear and deal with the trouble of people loading amps in and all that. So they would only say yes to certain people, and that became the key to a venue that reflected this very esoteric musical taste to these guys that ran it. And the next thing they knew, they were booking bands from out of town. And after a while, I'd go there on any night of the week, and there'd be people from Japan and New Zealand and Australia. I mean, just people from everywhere playing this weird little place. And it was, you know, and then the local bands that played there kind of flourished, and the people that hung out in the audience all got into the arts and formed bands later. So it was like, it was a place that had the sort of, you know, I guess it was an equivalent of someplace in New York like Max's Kansas City or CBGB or, you know, the Warhol Factory. That was a really interesting moment, and that had a lot to do with the development, I think, of Detroit breaking out. I think that place, and that was around the time Kim Fowley came into town too, and Kim Fowley had a lot to do with the outside world finally noticing Detroit. I brought him here to make a weird record in the mid to late 90s, and he was another part of it. But Zeus was never covered in the papers. It was completely underground. And it closed down before it got to be written about in any of the papers. So it really was truly underground. I mean, if you weren't in on it, if you didn't know someone who hung out there, you would just never have found out about it. And after it closed down, the scene kind of moved to the Magic Stick and the Gold Dollar, and it kind of became more of a bar scene again, which was, you know, which was great, but it was a little more like the way it was in the 80s. You know, it was just like, okay, you know, this is a rock and roll bar scene. This is a little more familiar. Whereas the Zoot scene was something very different for Detroit. You know, it was a whole different vibe. And there's a place now called Trinasoff, and Trinasoff over on Gratiot and Russell is sort of like, it's not a little house like Zoot's. It's a, looks like a giant, you know, gutted department store. And that place is an art gallery and music space. And that's the center of all experimental music and a lot of interesting ideas that are kind of outside the rock and roll thing, but, you know, but also connected to that. That's the center of all that right now.
What do you think your overall contribution to music is? What would you say it was?
You know, I think I'm trying to do stuff. I mean, it's like when I'm producing a rock and roll band or making a rock and roll record, I'm trying to just make something that won't sound ridiculous when you play it next to a Little Richard record. You know, I just want to capture the mysteriousness that fuels rock and roll and all music. I mean, I want it to be something where it's sort of, no matter what I'm doing, whether it's some kind of avant-garde experimental thing, or like the band I'm in now, Chatoyant, I'm playing with some strange guys from around town, and we've been working on some really bizarre stuff, you know. So through all my rock and roll travels, I've also done a lot of experimental things on the side, a lot of other stuff, you know. But whether I'm doing that type of music, you know, more improvisational, or if I'm doing a rock and roll record, it's sort of all the same to me, because I just want it to sort of be taken to another level where when you're experiencing it, you're hearing something that is the way it was back in the 60s or 70s when you'd hear you'd hear the new Rolling Stones record or a T-Rex record or a Bowie record. I mean, you were hearing something that you couldn't quite figure out, that was something that was filled with mystery, that was had a power where you didn't understand necessarily where it came from. It was just something something powerful that couldn't be explained. And that's what I'm after. I'm not after records that fulfill other people's expectations, or somebody says, well, I want you to do it this way or that way, or we want it to be this style or that style, or to conform to this. I want to make music that that only conforms to the highest standards of the past that that other people are trying to wipe out.
All right, finally, is there anything from this interview you'd like to expand on or something we didn't cover that you'd like to talk about? I know you mentioned your, the band you're working with now. We didn't talk about them. Or anything?
Trying to think. I think we covered a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people I didn't mention. Scott Morgan from the Rationals. I made a record with him, and done a lot of work with Andre Williams, who's one of the pre-Motown architects of Detroit music. Doesn't live in Detroit, but came back here to make some records, and I've done a lot of music with him. And the Destroy All Monsters guys, I've worked with them, particularly Kerry Lauren, and we've collaborated with John Sinclair too, and you know, so a lot of the things I've done are connected to other histories, you know, like Andre and Nathaniel go back to, you know, the Fortune Records thing, and Destroy All Monsters is sort of extreme importance in the art world because the things they did in Ann Arbor in the early 70s were just, you know, they were doing things that seemed insane but were revolutionary to the art world, and so I've kind of you know, I've managed to sort of cross paths with some people that are connected to like something that's a whole history there unto itself, you know, and I'm sure there's others I'm forgetting right now, you know, my prog rock band THTX and singer-songwriter named Denise James made 3 great records that ought to be reissued. I produced Slumber Party.
Do you do most of these things in a studio somewhere, or do you have a home studio?
Most of these records were done in recording studios, but you know, 10 years ago, I set up a studio in the house, basically to do that Pauline Jones record. When the blues guy was coming up here, that was when I sort of set up my own studio. I'd been working on an 8-track in a house doing these THTX records, which were kind of like these wigged out psychedelic progressive rock, you know, like really strange records. But when Paul Wine Jones came up from Mississippi, I set up an 8-track in my house, and I really intended it to just, you know, I was more concerned about just that project. But after that project turned out so well that people started, you know, asking me to do more records in the house, and so for the last 10 years I've done a lot of records in the house in the living room, you know, so it sort of became more of a studio setup like that. But after 10 years of making records in the house, I'm a little more inclined to seek out other rooms and just do, you know, just to keep it interesting, you know, like the house works, but it sounds good, it always sounds good. But after a while, you know, you want to, you know, you start to wonder what it will sound like in a different kind of room, you know. So like with Chatoyant, we've been recording everything just live, doing these stereo recordings of our improvisations in Trinasoft. So it's a gigantic space with a huge reverberating sound. So, you know, that's a whole other recording type situation. So, yeah. You know, try to do it all over the place.
And I don't know if you mentioned. Did you mention how you met Kim Fowley?
It was the Cream writer Ben Edmonds was back in Detroit, and I'd gotten to know him, and I stopped by his place one night. And he was doing an article on record producers, and he was talking to all these great record producers. He said, "Oh, I've got to call Kim Fowley later," and I said, "Oh, Kim Fowley, that's somebody I'd like to work with someday." Because I always loved Kim's lyrics, and his solo albums are really weird records. He was doing really strange stuff in the 60s. You know, I think he was even an influence on the Stooges. I mean, he was really doing weird stuff. Produced records that were a little more commercial, but his solo stuff, he was a poet and just a very, you know, intense and bizarre performer. And so I was always intrigued by him, and I mentioned that to Ben, and a couple days later, I pick up my phone and it's Kim you know, barking at me on the phone, what do you want to do? And, you know, next thing I know, I made arrangements for him to come to Detroit, and we made a record. And so that's how it happened. It was just this, you know, we got on the phone, we talked for a few minutes, and then the next thing I knew, I was recording with him. And then after that, after making the record Michigan Babylon, which I released in Detroit with the help of some record stores that financed the manufacturing of it, Kim turned out to just be a really good friend and sort of became a real ally in the music business, you know. And, you know, at a time when a lot of people were afraid of him because he was sort of, you know, kind of one of those guys like Phil Spector, Ike Turner, you know, where people were scared because of his demeanor and his personality. But, you know, I became friends with him, you know. I just thought he was a very brilliant guy with some real insights, real talent, you know. And then, you know, after we'd known each other for a few years, eventually he even became a DJ on Little Steven's radio network and started to do that. And, you know, and he passed away a few years ago. But when Kim started to have health problems, you know, it was a couple years before he died, he was having an operation, and he called me up and he said, you know, that he was going in for the surgery, and he was real worried about it. And he said, so he wanted me to set up two Detroit shows the week after his surgery, you know, and he's in his 70s at this point. And I'm like, okay, you know, so I set up an electric show and an acoustic show at the Hamtramck Blowout. So he came to town. He literally got off the operating table, hopped on a plane with his girlfriend, came over, And we did this acoustic show that went wonderfully, and then we recorded a bunch of stuff in my house, and then we did this electric show with the Dirt Bombs on the bill, and the show was packed, and it was, you know, it was kind of like he came to say goodbye to Detroit, really, I think, and because the city had always been a real big thing for him and his whole musical cosmology, and, you know, he did this show, and it was great, and... Then he went back to L.A., and his health kind of took a turn for the worse after that. So that was really like the last really, you know, it was like this very major performance for him, you know. And he was, you know, he was kind of received by the audience the way the Stooges were when they were reformed. I mean, people like got it, whereas when he came here the first time, people really didn't get it and thought, wow, this music is horrible and frightening and negative, and, you know. And then, of course, the world's changed since then, so now it doesn't seem so much. It just seems, you know, oh, it's normal now. But, you know, but I ended up going through the tapes in my house, and I, you know, mixed and edited and constructed what ended up being Kim's last album, you know. And he, like, I did it with him over the phone, and stuff, you know, so he basically got to see the final product, you know, before he passed away. But, yeah. So, but, you know, but we had an, you know, worked together over a period of nearly 20 years. Yep.
Well, if there isn't anything else you'd like to mention?
I think that covers a lot.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. All right.